Today is August the 29th, 1997, and I'm visiting with Jane Searles. Jane, I'd like you to discuss with me how the idea of Lawndale came about, and basically how you enriched that idea and implemented the whole thing, and how did it all start?
Well, I think any great concept starts with, in a sense, capturing the moment. It's like riding a prevailing wind. You happen to be wanting to go someplace, and that's the way the prevailing wind will take you. So you get to do two things at once. Lawndale came about because the art building burned. The painting building burned, the print building burned, and ceramics, sculpture, they shared an old building with architecture. Architecture had one end, art had the other end.
When was this? 70?
I'm guessing now, but maybe 79, 78, 80. The school, the power structure of the school came and said, "Oh my goodness, Mr. Searles, we are so sorry. The building burned. We just don't know what we're going to do. We're going to have to continue classes and put you somewhere, so we're going to put you in this old warehouse over a couple of miles off campus," which, as it turns out, that was Lawndale. Lawndale was the name of the street. This building was actually faced Lawndale, but its entrance was on Dismuke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I certainly didn't want to call it Dismuke, you know. But they put us over in that building, apologized, and left. And I was the happiest man on the planet. You know, it was like throwing Bo Rabbit in the briar patch. Schools, a lot of sculpture teachers, not just me, but the idea of the warehouse, the big raw space, I mean, that's a paradise for artists. You know, it's a paradise for, particularly for sculptors who, keep in mind now, are noisemakers, dust producers, junk collectors. You know, they have the most stuff that makes the most racket, that produces the most byproducts, residue, you know, so it's a problem. It was a problem at SMU, having sculpture in a building where the janitorial staff outnumbered the faculty. I mean, they buffed and mopped and wiped floors more than they produced art, because it's brick and mortar, it's clean, and this is the way it's run, it's systematic, and it's rational, and it's conscious. Everything that about it is diametrically opposed to producing art.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they try to house art departments in these ridiculous good places. So Lawndale came about, in a sense, you know, just because God struck the building with lightning and set it on fire, you know, and I happened to be the recipient of the good fortune. Now, so did some other people. They also moved graduate painting over to that building.
That's right, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Graduate painting had upstairs huge studios, great studios, good studios, high energy. You know what it's like? It's almost like playing in the freeway, in a sense. It's like putting yourself in the traffic. Lawndale was able to be the doorway of an enormous amount of traffic. You know, we just happened to be the right people, the right place at the right time to take care of a situation. You know, the most amazing thing about Lawndale to me was the fact that it was like being handed a race car and someone saying, "Hey, here's the keys to the car. You know, now you can go as fast as you want to go." Whoa, what an invitation, you know, I mean, the race car, not just an old jalopy, mm-hmm. You know. People thought it was an old jalopy. They thought, "Oh, poor people having to work over in that old hot building."
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I looked at it like a Ferrari. When I assumed the keys. Now, to tell you the truth, I just assumed directorship. No one gave me that. I mean, that's like pretending. That's like you when you were a little girl playing with your dolls and you're building a dollhouse and you're and my kids do that. They make up things.
Mm-hmm.
I just made it up. You know, it sounded good to me, so why not? I didn't really have, as this imaginary director, I didn't have an imaginary staff, but I had probably 30, 40, 50, 60 eager students available. They weren't all my students. Some were Gail's students, some were Richard's students, mm-hmm. you know, some were other people's students, like the graduate painting people. But I became pretty authoritarian in my willingness to just walk up and say, hey, I need 10 guys to come down here and move a stage. Now they could say, kiss my ass.
Right.
I'm not going to do it. Who gave you the right to come up here and tell me that I had to go move your stage? You know? But they were incredibly willing to participate. They said, sure. They would come down, we would move the stage, we would paint a wall, we would get ready for something. And those guys then got to come to the performance. That was their reward. See, they got to be there when the reality of the action took place.
Well, Lawndale then, you had, it was a working studio, it was an exhibition space, and it was a performance space. But the performance space was sort of a serendipitous thing, wasn't it? Because you were, from the school standpoint, the performance was coming out. You weren't working with Sidney Berger.
Oh, no. No, no, Lord, no. The Sidney Bergers of the world hate Lawndale. Excuse me. They've got their theater. They've got their Ferrari. And not only that, they don't want to give the keys to anybody else.
No.
They're not about to let you drive their car. Are you kidding? I mean, that would be like the football coach saying, oh, sure, our three people, come over, you can have our stadium. Forget it, they're not going to give you the stadium.
Well, who was doing the performing?
But all of the performing did not come out of U of H theatrical department, or it didn't come from the theater department, it didn't come from any of that stuff. That's not really where it came from. It actually just by osmosis came out of the community and then therefore came out of the students. There was a guy who died several years ago. His name is Lanny Steele. And if you're going to talk about the history of art during this period, you've got to go know who Lanny Steele is, what he did, what he meant to the community, who he brought here, when he brought them. He was one of the most important players in Houston. And Lanny had something called Some Arts. He started an organization called Some Arts. Some Arts was supposed to be the sum of the arts. Lanny would come to me and he would say, he taught music. Now this is ironic, okay, but he taught music over at, what's the other school right there by U of H? Where Biggers taught.
Texas Southern.
Lanny taught at Texas Southern. He taught music over at Texas Southern. Lanny was kind of a holdover from the Beat generation who still said cool and man and cat and daddy-o, and he used jargon that was of the 50s, you see. But he would come over and he would say something like, hey, I want to bring Ornette Coleman to town, and we need a place for him to play, and I'm going to pay him $4,000. And I don't have the money to pay him, so we're going to try to get the money at the door. Can we do it in here? And he would get the proceeds. I wouldn't get the proceeds. The school wouldn't get the proceeds. Now, anybody in the world, any business person running business would say, that's stupid. You know, like, you can't run a business like that. They're not going to let you use their theater without a $100 fee or Jones Hall's probably $2,000 or $2,500 a night or something. Lanny didn't have the money to book them into those places. So he would come over and he'd say, let's book them into Lawndale. Well, who are we going to get to hear that night? We're talking about someone who is in the Jazz Hall of Fame, Ornette Coleman. This guy was blasting double horns. I mean, he is a saxophone player extraordinary, who is painting back during the Abstract Expressionist times. I mean, this guy, his whole development was like Abstract Expressionist painting. This was the cooling of the saxophone,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
He would come out and play. He would pull both triggers. When he started playing, he blew your head off. I mean, from beginning to end, that's the way he played, you see. Well, all of a sudden, Fondale is packed with people. It's loaded. It's 300 or 400 people. And they're listening to this guy. These people, they don't know anything about art per se in that University of Houston tradition.
Right.
This is extra. This is expanding your audience. You know, we've got to expand our audience out of the university because we did things that involved people from outside the university. Lanny brought a lot of things to that place, to Rondale. He brought Chicago Art Ensemble. My goodness. The things that happened there to me were just extraordinary, and they really had to do with my willingness to assume this dictatorial authority, which I didn't have and was never officially given. And when people would come and ask me if they could do something, I'd tell them yes.
Sure.
Do you know how many people get told no?
Yep.
They get told no all the time. Artists can go to virtually anybody and ask for something or ask to do something. In a sense, they're asking this person to give them permission to do it. I just said, I give me permission to do it. I don't have to ask anybody. You know, if my chairman says no, then I'll just say, I'm too bad, I'm going to do it anyway, fire me. You know, if you don't like what I'm doing, run me off. But get out of my way. And I think, to tell you the truth, that's a very good way to teach.
Well, who was chairman at that time?
George Bunker.
Was he behind all this?
George Bunker. He certainly was not directly behind it, but George really liked something. George liked activity. George was a very creative person from New England, very reserved,
mm-hmm.
you know, and incredibly well respected, and actually tried several times to do something within the school itself and got kind of rebuffed a little bit. So I was all of a sudden like this alien. I'm just some guy from outer space who just lands in George's lap, and you know, I could go to George and tell him I was going to do something. He'd say, oh man, wait a minute, whoa, we got to think about this. Well, he would have to go to the dean, you know, the dean would have to go to the provost or chancellor. The first thing you know, it's a rigmarole, you know. So I wrote George a letter, about a 10-page letter, and said, George, I want you to assume my presence, you know, that I'm just going to do things. Just assume it a challenge. I will be a challenge to you. I'm going to do things and not tell you. And it's going to have the university's name on it. And you can say then, I didn't know. You know, I didn't know he was going to do that.
Yeah,
he didn't ask me if he could do that. So in a sense, it kind of let him off the hook.
Yeah.
You know, and which I think was good to do. But I found out something about what I call administrative people. There's two things that they like. One is they actually like for you to be doing creative things and making them look good.
Sure.
But boy, if you do a bust,
they don't like it.
They don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't like it. And consider the Museum of Fine Arts just for a minute. Let's make a lateral shift over here to the museum. The public really don't want them to goof. They cost too much, they're too big, they spend too much money for failure. You see, it's like having NASA fail, or, you know, I mean, you don't want failures of that magnitude. They don't want to do a show that the public's going to say is a dog. They want to do shows that the public say is great. Well, can you imagine where Dow Chemical would be without their laboratory? I mean, think about it. They have to have that lab, you know. Rondale was a lab. It was like the lab. Hey, let's go over to the lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically what it was.
Create.
There were some test tubes there were some things being tested over there. There also was a fairly significant, what you would call in the traditional sense, a failure rate,
mm-hmm.
you know. Regardless of how much I appreciated or how much I liked doing everything that we did over there and everything that took place, it all worked. Some of them were bombs, you know. So I think that you have to be able to do that. you have to have that place where you can take chances and run risk, and if the test tube blows up, you just simply say,
well, we learned.
Shit.
We learned.
We learned. You know?
What, how long did Lawndale go over there?
Well,
and
I don't...
And how did it close? I mean, how did it come around? Because I don't remember that.
Well, in what you would call the heyday.
Right.
You know,
which I would say would be 79 to maybe 80, I don't know, 4?
Yeah. Yeah.
About a
5-year run. I didn't make it 5 years. Chuck Dugan was the director after I left. And there's a casualty rate. You know, you can't run as fast as you can go all the time. I mean, at some point, you have to drop out of the race. You'll either run out of gas, you'll blow an engine, you know, or you'll hit a wall, or you'll do all three. You know, I probably did all three. You know, I mean, the amount of what you call time on task of dealing with Lawndale, that was an absolute beyond the pale full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, running Lawndale was, I mean, that was heated. It was a dead sweat, you know,
right.
The whole time. Plus, I had a career. I had to make my own art, you know, which I did. And plus, I had a domestic relationship, a life, a family, you know, that I had to not just maintain,
nurture,
you know, but to grow with and to function with. So I reached a point after about 3 years where I turned into a French fry, you know, and I just finally, in 83, it was actually after 4 years or a little longer, I said, hey guys, I'm sorry, I got to go to the house. You know, had I been able to just take a sabbatical and then come back or something, probably that may have worked. But I don't really know that it would. Lawndale presented a unique problem for the university. Lawndale was
time out.
They had a loose cannon in the ranks, and you know they certainly I believe looked at me as like I was a loose cannon. I would look at me. It's like someone who was willing to take responsibility for exercising creative will. You know, I mean, I never really looked at me as a loose cannon, but I did get to a point where I realized I did not figure in their long-range plan, you know. I was operating outside the university's 5-year plan, their 10-year plan, their 15-year plan. They looked at me as just something over here to deal with, and they didn't really know quite what to do with me, and they didn't know how to integrate Lawndale into their big picture. Had they done that, I personally think it would have been one of the most significant things that would have happened in education in the last maybe 3 or 4 or 5 decades. I mean, period, across
right.
the country.
Right.
You know. I think art should be 1/3 of the curriculum in public schools. That's a major statement. That's not a lightweight thing. I don't say that offhand. Art, philosophy, and science, that's what we should be teaching. Art is the ugly stepchild to universities. They just are. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the reason that music elevates, and the reason is because they have their symphony hall. They have their symphony hall. The reason that theater, the reason that Berger can be successful is he's got his theater. He has got his theater. Is it a good one? Damn right it's a good one. You know, it's real good. Architecture, hey, they go get Philip Johnson. Build them a grandiose thing that they can then all go in and grandiose it up. Artists at one time had some kind of place. there was a place for them in the community and in the society. And I don't necessarily know kind of where or what that is anymore. When the university did not embrace Lawndale to the point that they kept it and used it and developed it, I thought that was a tragic mistake,
mm-hmm.
you know, on their part. As far as I am concerned, they goofed. You know, that's a big goof. Now, that is why I say the road not taken is as important as the road taken. The reality is, Lawndale ultimately kind of got shoved to the streets. They had a problem with square footage over there. What do you do with a million square feet of space?
Then was that physical structure? How big was it?
Well, I don't know if it was a million. I made that figure up. But it was
okay.
huge.
Yeah.
It was huge. It was a city block. A full city block.
Probably several hundred thousand square feet.
Well, it had to be several hundred thousand
yeah.
square feet.
Probably 400 to 500 feet.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe more. Well, who are the, and looking back on what went on besides the musical, these 300 and 400 people shows, what else is going on there?
The students, not just sculpture students. Sculpture took a turn at Lawndale, where
mm-hmm.
sculpture wasn't just, I mean, you don't have to print this, but just to make the point, I'm going to say, sculpture moved beyond just being what you call the turd in the plaza
mm-hmm.
thing. You know, I mean, it really moved beyond it. I mean, the art guys came through that venue. Sharon Capriva came through, you know, that venue.
Right.
I mean, the person that's teaching sculpture there now came through, you know, that venue. There was, the students really was the lifeblood. I mean, they were the minerals. You know, they were the vitamins.
They always are.
Sure, absolutely. That was the key. That's what made Lawndale run. That's what made it work. I mean, that's what made the whole thing happen. I mean, those students were, just like I said, the painters were willing to come downstairs and move the stage. They didn't have to do that, you know. They did that because they wanted to be supportive. Artists, as a rule, are that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of...
They have a generous nature.
They have a generous nature in that sense. They have a generous nature as it would relate to the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, let's... I'm a gonna. Let's go... I mean, you know, they. If you throw something out, there'll be about eight hit it like bass. You know, I mean, they're an eager lot in that sense, and their reward is psychological. That's really what they get. They get a psychological hit off of doing things like that. If you go back and get the issue, I don't remember the year, but there was an issue devoted of Art in America devoted to Houston. Called The Third Coast. I've got it here somewhere, although I swear you go to the library and get it easier and I can dig it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called The Art on the Third Coast.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
That's a major article. It's like
mm-hmm.
a 10-page
mm-hmm.
article in Art in America. Really, really, really a serious review. You know something interesting? Better than one-third of that whole article was devoted to students at Lawndale.
Hmm.
Now, have you ever in your whole life heard of like a third of an article, a 10-page article in a national publication being devoted to over a third of it was devoted to what the students in a university are doing?
Hmm.
And it didn't really deal with them as students. It dealt with them as professional people. You know, they got to make the leap,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's like being shot out of a rocket, you know. Students don't get to do that. They graduate, they get their MFA, they go do this, they go do that, they yin yin, the first thing you know, I mean, this life's a drag. I mean, they end up being a banker or something, you know. I don't think universities really help them in that professional transition.
No, they don't.
You know?
They're not prepared.
They're not prepared to do that. And Lawndale did that. Lawndale put those students into traffic. It's like what I said, playing in the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
Those students were in the traffic. An enormous amount of traffic flowed right through their living room. They got to give the parties. They got to host the events. They also got to work on them. Which presented some problems, I have to tell you. That presented some problems for some of the other faculty because students would leave a class to come over and work on something. You know? So, what does a professor do? He's pissed. Hey, Fred, you're supposed to be in here drawing that model. You know? You're not supposed to be over there working on this symphony. There was a few scratches or gouges or little deals, you know. But to tell you the truth, in the scope of things, they were so minor. You know, Lawndale was one of the most beautiful moments of my life. You know, I loved being there. I loved being involved. I loved doing what I did. And I'm sure I'm not the easiest person to deal with, you know, all the time. Although I think I got along with people pretty good there, you know.
When did you come to Houston?
76.
And you came from where?
Charmaine and I came together in a red Ford one-ton truck with two pink suitcases.
I'm glad to know they were pink. Where'd you come from?
Dallas. I taught at SMU 7 years.
That's right. Well, let's see. You were just in town then when I first saw you because I came in 1975.
Well,
and I was not involved in the arts. And I began to become involved in the arts in 76. So
I had a show in Houston called 12 Texas that Jim Harris had done.
At CAM.
Mm-hmm. And then I had a one-person show here at the CAM. And I guess that show was probably in 75. I don't remember.
Well, tell me, when you came into town roaring in with your two pink suitcases.
No, we came roaring in.
Yeah, you and Charmaine.
Yeah.
How'd you find things? Who do you remember? What was it like? What was going on?
Well, we stayed at John and Wanda's place for about a month.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it seemed like 6 years to him. You know, we became the thing that wouldn't leave. You know, those kind of permanent house guests.
Right.
You know, that's the... It's really hard moving in with somebody else. You know, I mean, that's just tough.
Right.
And then Charmaine and I went to Florida, to Tallahassee I went down there and taught for a month. So then we came back, and then the month I think we went to Florida first, and then when we came back, we stayed at John and Wanda's house, and then we spent a month looking for this place. We'd come up here every day and just drive around and look and look and look, and we wanted to live someplace, you know, north of the airport. So the airport was accessible, the city was accessible, but we lived in the country. So we, basically, that was our goal.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about anything in particular about the art, what was going on in the visual arts in the 80s?
Well, Jim Harris was my entree into Houston. Jim Harris is the only person who I've ever met in my whole life who worked for a museum. And particularly a director, well, on any level. Jim Harris walked into my studio in Dallas, and he walked around, and he looked, and he looked, and he looked, and he said, "Hey, I really like this stuff. You want to do a show? And here's the date." In a sense, that had a whole lot to do with supporting art. You know, I mean, I'll give you some examples of that. Lawndale, there was a show at Lawndale called Art a Healing Force. There was a catalog for that show. Now, the reason that catalog took place is because I traded a piece of art to the guy who owned Texas Art Supply. But also, what happens if you needed to pay somebody $4,000 at the end of a concert and you only made $3,200? Where's the other $800 come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you going to get to 2 o'clock in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
You're out on the east side and standing in the door of a big old warehouse, and there's five guys standing there
wanting their money.
I mean, where are you going to get the money? Somebody's got to reach in their pocket. You know, I mean, and they got to do it right then. You know, I have seen Lanny at 3 in the morning drive to his mother's house and borrow $800, $900, $500, $1,000, in some cases a couple of $1,000s from, you know, out from under his mama's mattress. You know, and so they give it to him. I mean, it's, I mean, that's do or die. I mean, you are at a do or die moment right there. There's no business to it. There's no committees. There's nobody, no backup. You know, well, the same thing happened with me. You know, I would pull $800 out of my pocket. Well, now, I had the $800. That's a key. I had the $800 to pull out of my pocket and to hand to someone. You know, well, okay, $800 a year, you can deal with that. But what happens if it's $8,000? You know, what happens if it's, I mean,
we don't have it,
you know. And that becomes an issue. You know, you can live as far out on the edge as you want to go, but it's not really necessarily fair to take your family out on the edge with you. You can't take your kids out there and turn them loose because that's, I mean, now all of a sudden there's two worlds have to survive here side by side, simultaneously. They have to coexist, you know. And that's a real tough issue. That's a tough question, you know, to deal with. So, and that's part of what happened with Londale in terms of it, of me turning into a French fry. I mean, I spent a lot of money out there, you know, and I didn't go around, you know, telling people that or complaining about that. I did that because I wanted to do it. I liked doing it. I thought it was important. I thought it was important to the community. I thought it was important for me,
right,
you know, to do. So how can I do something? I absolutely, it's like a junkie. I call it being an action junkie, you know, and there are artists who are action junkies. Bill Steen did one of the best performances I've ever seen in my life out there. His daughter participated in it. It was a win. Where he whirled around and he helped us strike a stick and he busted teeth. Demi-test teacups off of his kid's head. These teacups, just these little demi-test teacups just exploded in the air. You know, that was major.
Yeah.
I don't even know, to tell you the truth, I don't even know where you'd go see that now. Maybe at Diverse Works, but Diverse Works took on a different agenda in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was an absolute political agenda that really had to do with the gay community.
It softened a little bit, I think.
It's genre. It has genre.
Mm-hmm.
It is now of a genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and well, that's great. It's like the Art League turning into MFA. You know, I mean, you grow, you expand, you do things.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just part of living.
What do you think is going to happen for artists in the next 10 years, 20 years?
For me or for artists?
Just for artists.
Well, I think that one of the things that made this successful back then is the fact that artists took responsibility for their own actions. They were willing to do things.
Mm-hmm.
They were willing to take responsibility for their own actions. And consequently suffer the consequences.
Right. That's
you
what
know?
Responsibility means.
That's what responsibility means. As best I can tell, you know, there may be a bit more kind of laying in wait, you know, kind of saying, oh, I can't do this because, or I can't do this because, there's too many reasons out there why they can't do something. you know. And mostly, those reasons are self-imposed, in my opinion. You're not really supposed to consider what's out there in terms of what you can or cannot do. You just do it and let the chips fall, you know. And if they, you know, you may get hurt. There's a possibility, you know, you get wounded.
Well, this has come from the beginning of time.
Well, absolutely.
This kind of stuff.
That's what entrepreneurialism is, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
And guys who can, I mean, Texas, for goodness sakes, I mean, is this the wildcatter state or what? You know, I mean, are we risk takers or what? You know, have we taken chances or what? Are we willing to go out on a limb or what? You know, I mean, there's been more rises and falls and busts in this state than probably anywhere in the world, and it's all been some guys do it and come back and do it and come back and do it and come back two or three or four times.
I feel that happening in the visual arts.
No, it's not happening now, but it did.